Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate you being here today. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be here moderating today's panel and webinar on understanding the AW condition code when credit reporting. The AW compliance condition code is intended to be used when noting an account is being impacted by a natural or declared disaster and has been frequently invoked during the past 2 months for individuals who've been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. But using that code is not always as easy or straightforward as it sounds. Today in this webinar, we have a panel of compliance experts from across the credit and collection industry who are here to share their perspectives about the AW condition code and try to answer any questions you have about using it. Let me take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. At least that's what my mother tells me. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. David Anthony is a partner at Troutman Sanders. He has a national litigation practice representing companies in highly regulated industries such as consumer financial services companies and class actions and complex individual lawsuits. He has significant litigation experience defending cases under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and numerous other federal and state consumer protection statutes, with particular expertise in matters that often involve companion government investigations. Alicia McKeegan is the Chief Compliance Officer at AFNI Incorporated. She's been in the industry for more than 10 years and has experience building and enhancing AFNI's compliance management system. She also has experience with FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA litigation and regulatory licensing. She's a member of the ACA Federal Affairs Committee and holds a credit and collection compliance officer designation with ACA. Katie Spicer is Senior Litigation Associate at Squire Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., where she's a member of the Czar's TCPA World Team. She specializes in complex litigation and government investigations to include consumer privacy litigation and data breach investigations. She first honed her consumer law acumen as a Marine Corps attorney, where she was responsible for advising service members about their various rights under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Truth in Lending Act, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and the Service Members Civil Relief Act. After 14 years on active duty, Katie transitioned to private practice at Squire Patton Boggs, where she now defends companies in high-stakes litigation and internal investigations. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please either use the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it in through the chat module. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area and should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's jump into our discussion. We're talking about the special comment AW, so let's first discuss what it is. Maybe Katie, you can walk us through that.
I think the best way to think about it is it's a disaster code that the credit bureaus came out with around 20 years ago. And the intent of it was to allow individuals to, or data finishers to accurately report financial hardship that was put on consumers as a result of a natural disaster.
Okay, excellent. It seems fairly straightforward, but obviously, as we get into our discussion today, we're gonna learn that there are a lot of ins and outs to it. So we've talked a little bit about what it is. Alicia, maybe you can talk about how it should be applied.
Sure, and thank you, Mike, for having me today. I think in terms of how it should be applied, it's really going to be dependent on your agency's policies. I listened to a webinar that the CDIA put on, and that was their response. But my opinion would be that however you apply it, it needs to be consistent. So for example, if you have a consumer from the same client and they say they're affected by COVID, and then you have another consumer from the same client that says they're affected by COVID, but they dispute the account, you choose to only put the AW on one and not the disputed account. That would be a concern of mine. So if you do choose to apply it, you need to make sure that you have consistent policies and procedures that would prevent you from having any inconsistency in treatment that would lead to consumer harm.
Okay. David, it seems to me, judging from what we've heard so far and sort of all, everything leading up to this webinar today, that there is some, it's not black and white, whether or not to use the code and how to use the code. We are talking, you know, sort of the need to apply it consistently, but why is there such ambiguity in how this code is used?
First, I want to again as well thank you for having me, and you know, I want to echo Katie's points and Alicia's point. Yeah, I think what you have to understand is that the code system that designates how all of this stuff is reported is not actually part of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. You know, the CDIA helps run the Metro 2 system and sets up a system with codes and things like that. None of those codes are law, and none of those codes are in the federal statutes. So where you end up with ambiguity is that, number one, the federal statute, the CARES Act, says certain things about what can and can't be reported when. And so then what happens is that the CDIA attempts to normalize that into some type of operational code. But again, the translation from what the CARES Act says to that code and the different views of it by different folks in the industry or consumers counsel, you know, is where the rub lies. And so, you know, what I've seen is, for instance, if someone calls you today, calls Alicia today and says, hey, I'm having a hard time paying my bill. Is that something that's caused by COVID? I don't know. Does she know? But, you know, the general view from the plaintiff's side is that the tie should go to the consumer. And so, you know, the AW code is meant to be sort of a non-negative, if you will, code, as opposed to saying, I didn't pay my bill, it's delinquent, I'm asking for forbearance. You know, those kinds of things have some sort of negative connotation to it. You know, the idea that you have a natural disaster emergency is sort of something that's beyond your control. And so I think the idea here is that, you know, that should be the cleanser from the perspective of we're going to hit the pause button. And it's not designed to cause anything negative. But I do think that you know, what Alicia said, I agree with. You know, you have to have your policies and you have to be consistent. And, you know, I think that what I see so far is that each company is sort of wrestling with what is their policy and what is their consistency. As Katie said, you know, the AW code was added years and years ago, but you know, I can't say that it's been something that's been regularly used over the past 20 years. It's going to get regularly used now, but it's sort of will be a lot of companies' knee-jerk reaction to rely on the other types of codes that they've used so far. I think the plaintiffs' counsel, you know, believe that the AW code should be used generously.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. As a reminder to anybody listening or watching, if you have a question or a scenario that you'd like to put to our panel and get their feedback on, you can use the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel, or you can use the chat module and send in your question or your comment, and we'll be sure to take care of it. So following up on something you mentioned just now, David, where, you know, if someone calls and says, I can't pay my bill, is it just a matter of asking? Do you have to, you know, do you ask, is this related to COVID-19? And if it is, then it gets the AW? I mean, is that like a simple way to sort of, you know, adapt a policy and procedure to just ask that question? Or is that not something that would be recommended?
Is that to me, David?
Yeah, sure.
Is that to Alicia?
Go ahead.
You know, I would be encouraged to sort of try not to put the, to be so direct. This is my instinct, not to be so direct with the consumer, but to talk to the consumer and try to get more information about that. Because again, I think that you have to understand that, you know, you have statutes like the FDCPA that assume that this consumer is the least sophisticated person. And I'm pretty comfortable that the typical consumer does not understand the Metro 2 codes. You know, half people have trouble with it, let alone consumers. And so, you know, I'd be interested in hearing what Katie and Alicia had to say, but I'm not sure that I would come out with my first question saying, is your failure to pay this payment due to COVID-19 so that I can check the appropriate box here internally? What do you guys think?
I think it goes along with what Alicia was saying earlier, just making sure that the compliance teams have policies and are trained to those policies and how they deal with those incoming calls and consumers' requests, whether they're going to require more information or whether it's going to be broad and sweeping. And going with what David was talking about earlier, I think part of some of the confusion as to what's going on is, I think historically with the AW code, it's been easy for data furnishers to look at a scenario like a Hurricane Katrina and say, okay, it's easy for me to identify those consumers that have been impacted. We can do a broad sweeping policy and apply the AW code. But here, yes, you know, COVID has impacted the world, but it's really putting the onus on the data furnishers to do in more of the individual analysis. So I'd be curious, Alicia, you know, just in line with that, how the policies are working out from the compliance side.
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the things that you have to consider is, you know, kind of your call flow. And so at least, you know, on the AFNI side, part of some of the operational call flow is that when someone says that they can't pay, we ask questions to help us understand, well, you know, why can't you pay the bill right now? What circumstances are you facing? You know, can we talk about sources of income and you know, the conversation evolves. So, you know, one of the natural things that we've gotten from our conversations with consumers with that type of conversation is that they tell us, well, you know, I'm unemployed right now. I lost my job because of COVID, or, you know, I really don't have a lot of money. So some of that information that an agency would use in order to potentially put this AW disposition code on the account can be obtained just kind of in the natural course of a conversation with a consumer, just having a discussion about why they can't pay the account. I think, you know, in furtherance of the discussion on why is it so confusing, and I think David hit on this, is that it was never anticipated that it would be used this way. You know, there is there's a CFPB report and a letter from the NCLC that they were talking about this disaster code back in 2019, and when Hurricane Harvey hit, and the inconsistency with the creditors that are applying it between the mortgage industry and the credit cards. And you can see kind of in that discussion from the CFPB and the NCLC's letter to CDIA and the credit reporting agencies that this code was anticipated to be used in those exact scenarios, in hurricane scenarios. The CDIA webinar that I listened to, you know, quoted it being used during 9/11. So, you know, it was never anticipated that this would be used during a pandemic. So there is so much up in the air in terms of how agencies are going to apply this, because, you know, it's not anticipated for this scenario. But I will say that, you know, I've quoted a number of resources that my company has used to kind of guide our policies and procedures. And I will make those available to the attendees, both the NCLC letter, the CFPB's report on the disaster code, and the CDIA's webinar. Those have been beneficial to us in informing us on our policies and procedures.
You know, I'd like to add a couple of points to that. You know, number one, just we haven't specifically mentioned it, but, you know, aside from the webinar that the CDIA did, they also issued a couple of bulletins that provided certain guidance. And while it's not perfect, they are useful tools to look at too. There's two FAQs that have been added, and there's some background information as well. And, you know, I'm happy to provide that, or you can get that off the CDIA's website. I think that echoing, you know, Alicia's point too, what's odd here is that, you know, typically you have a hurricane blows through, that's kind of it. You know, the way the CARES Act is written, you know, you have this it running from this period of an emergency, and then it running from 120 days after that. And, you know, what I can tell you with, I mean, to me, there's two answers to almost all of these questions that we're talking about. One of them is, what is our best way to analyze the technical correctness of the advice in order to try to glean the best information we can to try to do it right? And then the second is, what is your litigation risk? And your litigation risk sometimes may have nothing to do with whether you got it right or not. You know, as a simple example, my guess is, if using the examples we talked about, you err on the side of putting AW as opposed to not putting AW, my guess would be that you're more likely to get sued by leaving AW off than by leaving AW on. And that doesn't mean that that's exactly spot on with the right answer, but I do think that you have to look at all of these questions that we're talking through the lens of litigation risk.
Sorry,
and, you know, I guess one other quick point there is that, you know, the all of the guidance that sort of has come out from the CFPB, from the state AGs, from the CFPB, from NCLC or the plaintiffs bar, you know, all of them really have said simplistically, during this time period, look out for consumers, right? And so if you think about how this is going to look in 3 years when there's litigation, trust me, the facts will become a little bit more murky, and particularly for those in the industry that don't record the calls. I mean, I could totally see the calls here being really critical to what was provided to an agency in terms of what they're reporting or not. And when you have folks who do not report, then obviously do not record, then it's a he said, she said, and chances are that may be a jury question.
Good point. Thank you. To those of you who are logged in and watching, Alicia's put some of the links to some of the resources that we mentioned in the chat box. So you should be able to grab them from there. If you can't, by all means, reach out to me and I'd be happy to make sure that you get what you need. We've got a couple of questions that have started coming in. The first one is a fairly straightforward, or not a fairly straightforward one, but one I think that I wanted to ask as well. What are your thoughts on doing a blanket update with the AW code to all reported accounts? Thumbs up, thumbs down, or, you know, it depends. Anyone want to talk?
I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I can take that one, Mike. You know, we aren't currently doing that. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. We aren't currently doing that. I think that, you know, where there are circumstances that would require us to update that, you know, we are doing so. I think to David's point, the company needs to evaluate their litigation risk. So if you think it's in your best interest for you to update the AW code on all the information that you're furnishing, then you should do that. And that kind of takes away the point that I made earlier in terms of inconsistency, because if you're furnishing a trade line, that AW is being furnished. Now, CDIA's direction has been that just because there are individuals affected, you know, by this natural disaster, i.e. you could say the entire United States is, because it's a, you know, national emergency declaration, that doesn't mean that you should also report this for every account furnished. So CDIA's direction is not to do that. But again, I think you need to look at your own personal policies and procedures for your agency and assess the risk of not doing it. The other part of it is, again, if the information is being provided to you, I think that's the critical factor. The point that you are informed that this person has been affected by COVID in some way, that is the trigger point for me to be able to make that decision on what you're furnishing and what you're not. And if you feel like you can't furnish information accurately, you always have the opportunity to remove it or not furnish. And so, you know, the agencies aren't in a situation where they have to finish this AW and they think it's going to be inaccurate and put themselves at risk. You can always just choose not to furnish information and remove the risk in that way.
I think some of the concern to doing a broad sweeping coding is that there are some individuals that just aren't impacted in the same way as others right now, and have the ability to pay and want to keep increasing their credit profile. I mean, an example that I think of that's near and dear to my heart is the military and service members. I mean, they're still working, they're still getting paid. And what we're coming upon is the move season, the big PCS season. And what's really important for service members when they're moving, oftentimes their best asset is their credit score. Because when they move, they're relocating, they're looking to get a mortgage. They may be relocating to an area where they have to get a new car. Spouses may be applying for new jobs. So while the AW code will neutralize an individual score, some consumers that are able to do so may want to keep improving their credit profile. So I think kind of that may be where some of the tension is.
Yeah, and I think that I kind of probably take a middle approach between those two views. You know, I think a lot of it depends upon where you are. You know, if you are not, say, in the pure debt collection space, the likelihood is that you've got customers that are paying their bills on time, right? And so you might look at that in a slightly different way as opposed to someone who already is in a delinquency. You know, as a general proposition, you know, CAA wants you to report accurately. And so if you don't know that the consumer has in fact requested an accommodation, then theoretically the AW code is not spot on for that. I mean, getting to Alicia's point, you know, that may very well be the implication by that for folks who are in, you know, the collection space. But, you know, echoing Katie's point, at the same time, if you are with an AW code, your account is essentially neutral in terms of the credit reporting. And so, you know, there's certainly, I will bet you that there will be a case in 3 years where someone put an AW code on and the person says, I never asked for an accommodation. And because I had this AW code on, mortgage company Y, inferred that I failed to make payments and had asked for a mortgage and they didn't give me a mortgage here. And so therefore you violated the Fair Credit Reporting Act. You know, ordinarily, if you do something that benefits the customer or the consumer, you're not going to get in trouble for it. Here, putting the AW code doesn't benefit the consumer unless it's negative. But if it's positive, then theoretically it's having a negative impact on them. So, you know, I know it's probably more of a pain, but I'm probably more of a fan of looking at the individual circumstances. But I think it's really important, you know, and that doesn't necessarily undermine Alicia's point, because I think it depends on the industry, because that response might be different from industry to industry.
To your example, David, that you were just giving about, you know, sort of looking 3 years ahead, does the converse also, you know, is that a possibility where somebody, you know, says, you know, sues because they, you know, even though their credit wasn't impacted or whatever, they can still sue because the AW code wasn't put on the account? Is that something that you're going to see as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think we're going to see all permutations of this. I think we're going to see you shouldn't put on the AW code. You put on the AW code. You didn't put it on fast enough, took it off too slow, you took it off too fast. Then when you report it, when you put on the AW code, you're also required to report the information accurately. So there'll be complaints that you messed up that part. And then it's as well, when the AW code comes off, you know, you've got to make sure that that's accurate. And so, you know, I'll just give you this example. What happens if someone is making their payments, they then don't make their payments during the period of the accommodation in the AW, and then the emergency is over, and then they are, you know, let's call it 35 days late on the payment. And what do you report? Is it 35 days late? Do you go back over the period of time? And just the granularity of all of that stuff is going to be picked apart, in my view, by the plaintiff's counsel. And I think you're going to, despite everybody's best efforts, there's going to be a lot of litigation about this.
I also think that goes to the point of just making sure that organizations are making informed decisions and having those written policies and consistently applying those policies. And that's going to help when the floodgates inevitably open.
You mentioned
policies. A critical point, Mike. Let me add a point there, because I think this is really important. You've got two issues. On the front end, you've got the furnisher's obligation to provide information to the extent that they choose to do so within the FCRA system. On the back end of that, you know, ordinarily a furnisher is not liable under the Fair Credit Reporting Act unless there's been a dispute. So, you know, I think from a training perspective, you know, the folks in the industry need to be extra vigilant on the backside of this and how they handle disputes, because let's assume for some way you got it wrong on the front end, you've got an opportunity to make it right on the back end. And if you make it right on the back end, there's no litigation risk. If you are, you know, sloppy on the front end and you're sloppy on the back end, you'll pay the price for that.
To piggyback on your point, David, thank you for bringing that up. I think that even goes as granular as looking at every single dispute code that can come in through the indirect disputes, and then having a guide to your agents that are reviewing it. This has potential to reflect a COVID-19 impact. You know, be extra cautious about this particular dispute code, even if it's not written in black and white, right? Pay attention to the FCRA comments that are in the indirect disputes. I think that, you know, there's a lot of coordination that goes into furnishing in general, but it's not just the initial furnishing that you're doing on Metro 2. It is your recovery, you know, your representatives that are reviewing the disputes that are coming in, the decisions that they're making, the materials that they're reviewing, what they're noting on the accounts, again, to the policies and procedures and the consistency. Especially if you're then going to go back and defend that, you know, against potential lawsuits and potential risk. So I'm glad that you brought that up, David. I would strongly encourage any debt collection furnisher that is responding to indirect disputes to get that granular with your instructions to your agents.
Yeah, and I'd echo two slightly different points on that. And, you know, point number one, think about it from the standpoint of, if you're a defendant in 3 or 4 years, what's going to be your story, right? And so what Alicia was describing there was a real story, right? It wasn't business as usual. It wasn't our folks who were reviewing disputes were doing the exact same thing in 2020 that they did in 2019, irrespective of COVID-19. You know, your policies ought to reflect that difference. And if you stand up in a jury trial in 2022, and during the entire COVID-19, you were tone deaf to COVID-19 because you're doing it the exact same way you did in 2019, you're going to get killed. If you tried, you genuinely tried to go to do something about it, you know, you've got a story to stand up and say, you know, you weren't being, willful in your conduct, et cetera. And again, a lot of it depends upon the magnitude of your disputes, because if you get a modest amount of disputes, maybe you pick up the phone and you call the consumer, right? If you get hundreds of them, that's a different thing. But please, please, please don't respond to your disputes about all of this just like you did 5 years ago, because they're not going to get looked at through the same lens.
And David, I've talked to different agencies that have had, you know, now credit repair organizations that have always abused the indirect dispute system, but even more so now, sending essentially baiting disputes. So I think that's something to definitely be aware of. You know, when you talk about volume of disputes, it just reminded me of the fact that there are credit repair organizations that are attempting to flood agencies right now with disputes surrounding COVID, and that are, you know, not so specific and are vague. So just something to be aware of that's occurring right now.
No, and there's another ripple effect, and then I'll be quiet, like Katie talked for a while, because I've been talking too much. And that's this, you know, when you have disputes COVID related, or they are based upon some credit reporting, you know, it's challenging to do that in a remote environment. You know, you don't have your files, or maybe your systems aren't, depending upon how your company is, you know, or depending upon, you know, I've heard instances with some where the CRAs are taking a little bit longer to get the disputes to the furnishers to review, which then eats into your time. So, you know, that creates another issue that, you know, let's assume you have a dispute, you might not have an ordinary time period for the dispute or an ordinary circumstance to allow your people to do that. And that's a separate question. But it's impacting all of this on the furniture side, and again, the consumer gets the tie.
All right, I'll jump in. We've got a few more questions that are coming in from the audience. Let's ask this one. How long after should the AW, code remain on a credit report? Katie, you want to walk us through that, or your advice on that?
I think that's the moving target question right now. If you look at the CARES Act, it says that the accommodation is 120 days after the declaration ends. So I think the timing is going to be variable on what the federal government is saying. Obviously, some states are going to be opening sooner. I think, you know, it's just going to have to be an informed decision that you're making. But then you also have to understand that consumers are going to be impacted differently. And there may be some that have lost their job as a result of COVID. And even though certain declarations are coming out and saying, hey, you can in theory stop recording at this point in time, that individual consumer may take months to get on their feet. And there's still a causal relationship between COVID and the job loss and their economic hardship. So again, I think that's going to be another internal policy driven decision based on both what governments are saying, but then both on what is going on in that individual consumer's circumstance.
That segue, go ahead, Alicia, go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to add just a little bit. Based on those resources that I provided in the chat box, you know, it was interesting again to read this as it related to the hurricane scenario. And the NCLC suggested that it remain on the credit report for 6 months after the natural disaster, right? I know in the CFPB's report that I read that on average it was remaining on consumers' credit reports for 2 months. And again, we're not comparing apples to apples here, but I thought those timeframes were interesting. For debt collectors that are not, you know, that are third-party debt collectors that are not debt purchasers, you know, perhaps you just consider keeping it on the credit report for the life of the account. You know, you're going to have it for 6 months, 9 months, maybe 12 months. So from a risk perspective, why not just continue to furnish it for the life of the account? And then when it moves on, the next agency can make the determination on if they want to continue to furnish it.
Yeah, and the only comment that I would have on top of that would just be to remember, at least for something that is under the CARES Act and is an accommodation, right? Then, you know, there's the 120-day rule that applies to that. So, you know, I don't think that you're going to have a consumer who's going to call you and say, okay, I'm withdrawing my accommodation on day, you know, 13, and so you can stop now. You know, that translation isn't going to work. And I suspect, too, that one of the things that has happened is that, to me, this situation has highlighted the difference in opinions with the current CFPB, state attorneys general, and, you know, other regulators, that I would be really surprised if there's not additional guidance that comes out over the next 3 to 6 months on a lot of these issues, particularly as it starts to wrap down, hopefully. But again, I think part of what's really challenging about this too is that, I mean, if you were to put aside the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I know is very difficult for us all to do, it's exciting as it is, and were to say, when is this all going to be over? You know, if you talk to parents about when their kids going to go back to school, or when can you have college football, or when can we go back to work? You know, there are people that say not until we have a vaccine that's effective. There are other people say, you know, when the infection rate goes down for 14 days in a row. And, you know, I think that you're running into some really risky territory if you're the arbiter of when the natural disaster emergency is over.
Talking about the 120 days, a question asked, when did that period begin? Does that begin when a state declares an emergency, the federal government? Does anybody have any insight?
It's the federal. It's January 31.
So 120 days from then.
No, it's 120 days from the. That was the date of the declaration of the emergency, and it runs to 120 days following a declaration from the end of the emergency. And that declaration of the emergency isn't just the president deciding that he wants to tell everybody it's an emergency. You know, it's a. It's there are special indicators in terms of, you know, regulations being lifted, emergency funds being able to go. So it's you know, it's going to happen at some point in time. And then it's 120 days after that. And I would encourage you, if you haven't, I'm not going to tell you to read the entire CARES Act because you're full asleep, but the CARES Act portion as it relates to the Fair Credit Reporting Act is only about 5 or 7 pages. And I would encourage each of you to do that. And that's probably something else we can add online.
Katie, circling back to policies and procedures, is it a sort of door one, door two, door three that, you know, an agency has to sort of decide what its policies and procedures are going to be, because it seems like there are so many different variables that have to be taken into account versus, you know, sort of just kind of everybody sort of following the same, you know, everybody picking the same door, to continue to use my metaphor?
I think it's going to be very organization dependent. I mean, everybody's in a unique situation. You know, going along with the policies and procedures that David and Alicia were talking about earlier with regards to disputes, I mean, something that everybody needs to keep in mind too, that it's not just future plaintiffs that are going to have a story to tell, it's going to be defendants and companies as well. And part of that too, specific to dealing with the dispute process, is making sure that you're documenting internally now the operational hardships that you're having in responding to disputes. You know, I think before this, you had dispute teams that were co-located and could immediately react and respond to things. And now you've got people and organizations that are dealing with the same remote issues and operational issues that the rest of the world is. So I think it's very important to make sure that you're capturing, you know, the operational issues that you're having as well. But you know, I don't think there's one certain system that's going to work for every organization.
Katie, I think that's an excellent point that you make. You know, one of the things that the AFNI is doing is we have specific COVID reports that we've issued to our compliance committee. So that touches on how we're handling disputes, how we're handling controls, how we're, you know, what policies and procedures are in effect. You know, something that I've learned from past events is that you think you're going to remember how that control went into place, or, you know, what you modified, or, you know, whatever the change may have been. And you're 2-3 years down the road, and you're like, okay, where did that document go? What was that? So, you know, as much organization as you can around anything that affects, that's related to COVID, your policies and procedures, your reporting, your disputes, your agent talk-offs, any additional training that you're providing to your agents, any interaction you're having with state regulators, any interaction you're having with federal regulators, any guidance that's coming from state and federal regulators. I mean, that way it's very pretty in package for inevitably when, you know, a couple years down the road, you're going to have to look back on this and, you know, remember exactly what was happening. Because let's all not forget, you know, We all are dealing with, you know, our own home situations as well, whatever that may be. And so it's a chaotic time for a lot. And so having that information nice and condensed and packaged, I think, is extremely helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a superb point. And to me, that is takeaway number one from this session. You know, people are not going to remember what happened, and it's going to require a tremendous amount of diligence with all of the moving parts to go to stay on top of all of that. But again, if you don't do that, it's going to get lost. And trust me, you know, someone's going to tag you for something and you're going to say, well, that's not what happened. And you're not going to have a document that supports that. And so, you know, whether you have a standing committee or whether you have one person or the chief compliance officer, you know, whoever it happens to be, you know, and for big companies, that's one thing. For smaller companies, that's more challenging, but, you know, it is probably your number one risk mitigation tool that you can use. Because I think simply doing it, it forces you to go through the process and be thinking, okay, what are we doing differently? What materials are we looking at? How are we, you know, how are we adjusting to this? And if your weekly report says we haven't done anything past week, you know, that's not going to sound good. Whereas your weekly report says, you know what, we went to the CDIA training, you know, we read this report, we looked at the new legislation, you know, we got some training through you know, Mike's organization, you know, there's a lot of things you can do. And I think there's a difference in being perfect and being lazy.
I think something to keep in mind with all this too, is that the credit bureaus are now allowing consumers to check their credit reports for free until April 2021. And so you think, I'd be curious, Alicia, maybe if you've seen this yet, but with more frequency checking and consumer insight, whether they're gonna be more engaged with their various lenders.
Well, and you know, one of the inevitable questions that's going to come out of all of this is the extent to which your clients that, you know, the folks here on the phone work with, or your collection efforts are impacted by this. And I can assure you that I'm going to get a call from someone like Alicia who's going to say, hey, I hear the word on the street is that Acme Collection Company isn't doing this. Why am I doing this if they're not doing that? And, you know, and the answer might be because they're wrong, or the answer might be because they're in a gray area. The answer isn't always just because they thought about this and reasonably considered it and come to a different conclusion. You know, there are folks, as you know now, who are all over the spectrum in terms of where they are on risk, ranging from trying to be extra compliant to not really caring. And so, you know, there are going to be some bad actors in the space that give some of you guys a bad name.
I think I just want to clarify that David said Acme and not AFNI. He was talking about his collection agency before.
I was trying to suggest that the good one was AFNI. That's what I was trying.
There you go. A couple more questions have come in. One of my last reminders. We only got a few minutes left before we wrap up. So if you have a question for our panel, type it in now and we'll get it asked. The next question is, we have customers sign up for an accommodation, we apply the AW, then they come back and opt out. Should the AW come off at the opt out or at the 120 day after they opt out? Anyone want to weigh in on that one? You can see the wheels.
I'm not sure the statute speaks to that. I mean, I have to think that one through a little bit. I guess what I'm trying to think through is if you have an accommodation, you have the 120 day rule. If you don't have an accommodation, you don't necessarily have to have that 120 day rule. But I guess on the flip side of all that too, it to me, it depends. Like for example, if they call and they say, hey, I'm able to pay my bills from now on. Okay. Is that a withdrawal of the accommodation request? You know, I will find it hard to believe that a consumer will call on day 63 and say, you know, Katie, I'd like to withdraw my AW code from the credit report. I mean, that's not likely to occur. And again, if you go back through the discussion we had where, you know, if there is a problem with that, you know, you do have an opportunity to fix that in the dispute. And if somebody thinks it's a big deal, then you say, you know, fine, I'm happy to fix that. I thought I was looking out for you.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question and scenario. And I think it kind of ties into something Alicia was talking about earlier with training those on the front line that are having the conversations with the consumers that are calling in. And that would just be, you know, ensuring that the appropriate follow-up questions are being asked, because there could be educated consumers, savvy consumers that may want that AW code off because they want to stop neutralizing their credit score and, you know, starting to increase their credit profile. So that's an interesting scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the client is sophisticated enough and seems to, you know, wanting to get their credit report correct, I mean, that, you know, the increase because of payments and things like that, you know, that's certainly something that you want to take a careful look at, because you want to put the consumer in the best light. And again, you know, one of the webinars that I heard recently involving plaintiffs counsel was just highlighting the need for the information when you take the AW code off to be accurate. So again, you can think through that context that if you were Alicia and you had a a consumer who called on day 61 and no longer wants the accommodation, you know, chances are, you know, they are trying to apply for mortgage or credit or something. And, you know, if you don't get it right or consistent with what they expect, you know, you may have a problem.
Another interesting question that's come in. I'm curious to hear what each of you have to say. What do you answer when a debtor asks how this code will affect their debt or their credit? How do you explain the code will neutralize their debt, and when it's going to disappear, will it affect their credit score? How would you answer that question?
So from an AFNI perspective, all of our agents are trained not to answer those baiting questions, not to provide any information on the potential effect to a consumer's credit score. And so they would respond with something to the effect of, I'm not a credit expert, I can't provide that information to you. However, you know, if this information is furnished, we'll provide accurate information.
That's a great policy.
That's
really good.
Yeah, that's the right answer in terms of from someone like Alicia. I think that, you know, the reality is that if you are applying the AW code, it's not supposed to negatively affect the consumer, right? But as Katie pointed out, there is a difference in terms of if a consumer is paying their bills on time versus it being neutral, right? Neutral is not the same as positive. And it's not the same as paying the bills and reflecting that. So, you know, to somebody who is very ambitious about their credit score, applying an AW code could result in them not getting a higher score. But at the end of the day, it's not supposed to affect the score. And again, if I had to predict, there will be somehow, some way, some folks whose credit score is affected either during the process or at the end of the process, the removal of the AW code through something. And so, you know, it's just something that we'll have to see how it all plays out. But I don't think it'll go smooth as silk.
Another situation that may not go smooth as silk. What if in 9 months the consumer files a direct dispute and the comment says remove the AW code, and we are beyond 120 days, do we remove the AW code?
You always have the I don't have a specific answer to that one. I'll leave that to Katie and David, but whenever in question, you always have the option to delete it, right? So in that specific scenario, if you feel like you're being baited, you know, and the consumer's requesting you to remove information and you're well within, you know, your legal rights to do so, you can certainly proceed with removing it, or you can just delete the furnished information.
Yeah, I think the thornier question is to delete it early as opposed to deleting it later.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Another question.
Let me raise one issue there. So, you know, another issue that is going to happen in my view is that you're going to have President Trump issue an order lifting the national emergency at some point in time. And my prediction is there will be at least one state where that's continuing on past that point in time. And so, you know, then what do you do? And so, you know, it might be perfectly legitimate to keep the AW code on there. If that's in fact still relevant in your particular jurisdiction. I mean, I think I've heard this. It's the first time in the history of the United States that all 50 states have a declared state of emergency at the same time as the federal government. And so, you know, this is not going to be a uniform end. And so there will also be a ripple effect on the reporting that way too.
We've talked about there being a lot of different variables and a lot of different scenarios that are possibly in play with respect to consumers and this code over the last, you know, hour or so. How do you develop a set of policies and procedures to deal with all of these different possible scenarios? Or is it just a matter of doing your best to try and cover as many of them as possible?
Well, Mike, I think for us, it was, you know, going to first developing a shell of the policy and procedure that we thought had all the information it needed. And then just evolving over the next couple weeks, couple months, and slowly adding different information based on the circumstances that were coming up. Also engaging with peer groups, understanding what other agencies are doing, what they're including in their policies and procedures. Also paying attention to what are the regulators issuing in terms of their guidance? What questions are being asked by the regulators? What industry articles are providing information on what plaintiff's attorneys are doing, or different publications that might provide some guidance. So I don't think it's no policy should be a set it and forget it situation. It should always be an evolving policy, but even more so on COVID-19, I think that you start with a shell and you continue to learn and grow that policy over time.
I think another important point to make with that too is, yes, you have the living, breathing policies, but making sure that you're consistently training the frontline workers to those policies as they're happening, because I can envision scenarios when they start to get interviewed and questioned down the road and they say, oh, I had no idea that we even had that policy. I was never trained to it. And you could have had the best policy, most reasonable policy in place given the circumstances. So making sure you're training to it as well.
And Katie, I think I think that's an excellent point. And one thing that I think that COVID report has provided for us is kind of another audit measure. You know, as we're going through and providing that report to our senior executives and our compliance committee, we're looking at these different scenarios and these different things that we're reporting on, and it's, oh, have we done that? Have we revisited this? You know, one of which is training agents. So I would echo your point and also say that, you know, going back to the report that you may be providing or some type of documentation, that serves as a nice reminder.
Yeah, and I would say it, here are my observations. Number one, many folks already had some kind of policy. They might have called it a hardship policy. Many folks, it's just been a revision of their hardship policy. But secondly, getting to Alicia's point, I think there are, when I write a policy, typically, I'm looking and I want to make sure I address what the code sections say and what the regulatory guidance, that I'm kind of hitting those hot spots, which requires you to kind of stay on top of that. But, the idea of a policy and procedures are to give you a framework. They're not designed always to address every single point that goes along with that. Sometimes there can be FAQs that go along with that. Sometimes there can be training that can go along with that. Sometimes there can be an update that goes along with that. And it doesn't necessarily have to have a policy and procedure that's getting updated literally on a daily basis. But I do think that, trying to understand what really is a framework for decision-making as opposed to what is a particular circumstance, have your people trained so that they understand. And, one of my pieces of advice to all my clients are, when you have the high-risk areas, the people who are having the most communication with consumers ought to be your best ambassadors, not your worst ambassadors, because they can oftentimes speak to the consumer in a certain way, alleviate the pressure in the room, and hopefully have a consumer walk away with a good experience, as opposed to having somebody who's awful and all it does is fan the flames. So I do think that it's challenging. I also think that one of the things that I've seen and I've encouraged with my clients are what's really going on here is the normal process that you would go through on policies. It's just happening at warp speed, right? So to me, it would encourage me to go back and look at my process for revising any policies and procedures, because it really ought to be the same one. It's just you're having to do this portion of it either temporarily or permanently a little bit more quickly. And so, you've got to just understand that this is not, we go and we do an annual review. That's not the way this is working right now.
Excellent. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but before we wrap up, I'd be remiss if I didn't give each of our panelists a chance to summarize their thoughts, share any parting words of wisdom, any key takeaways, what they're watching on Netflix, a chance to sort of share what so whatever concluding remarks they wanted to share, and we'll go around the panel. David, we can start with you.
All right, I'm watching Ozark on Netflix. That's what I'm watching right now. My daughter wants to watch Dance Moms, which I do not want to watch. From a piece of advice perspective, I would just say, I encourage everybody to look through what they're doing, how they're responding to consumers, with an eye towards the inevitable litigation risk that's going to come. Don't assume we're in a vacuum. Don't assume everyone's going to forget about that. And to take some of the best practices that we've talked about here today, that Katie and Alicia highlighted, you know, have your policies and your procedures and your training and pay attention to what's going on in the industry. My guess is if we did another one of these in 6 months, we'd have a lot more intelligence in terms of what's actually going on and what further guidance we've had to be able to amplify that. And then in 6 more months, you know, it'll be even that way. And probably in 3 years, we'll be probably talking about a series of COVID-19 litigation cases, and everybody will run back and change your policies and procedures again. So that's mine.
Well, excellent. Thank you. Thumbs up to Ozark, and my daughter's watching Dance Moms too, so I won't touch that. Alicia.
My Netflix is not as exciting. I have 3 young ones, so we're watching Little Baby Bums on the regular. It's animated nursery rhymes. It's a great time. Super Pig is my favorite. I would say my advice is kind of what I've tried to provide, you know, throughout this entire webinar, is that document, and audit, and, you know, repeat, right? So it's, I think Ontario published an article that said that COVID-19 is the ultimate test to your CMS, right? And so it's take COVID-19 and everything related to it and go through your compliance management system and see if you're hitting all the different places that it could touch in your compliance management system, your complaints, your escalation, your board management oversight, your policies and procedures. Just, you know, be very thorough in your review and your documentation.
Well said, and I guess I both miss and don't miss those shows as my kids have gotten older. So enjoy it for now. Katie.
Well, Mike, just to close out, I do want to thank you for having us. I am watching the Michael Jordan documentary, even though I am a Detroit native and a Detroit fan, but I will publicly admit it, it's actually pretty good. But my advice would be just to make informed decisions. And if you're about to take action on something and you don't really know what you should be doing, just ask the questions and just try to avoid doing anything arbitrarily. And, you know, we're gonna get through this, and that's all I have to say right now.
Awesome. As someone who grew up in Windsor, I remember the Bad Boys, and they were the best. So listen, Katie, David, Alicia, thank you so much. I'm just looking at a note in the chat that, you know, very helpful. I couldn't take notes fast enough, and I've got a bunch of my own. So this was really comprehensive, really informative. Thank you so much for sharing with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for having us.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Thanks for participating. We've got more webinars. Tomorrow is handling disputes. Monday is how to reopen your office. Tuesday is sales and marketing. Wednesday is converting online training. And Thursday is what's going on, how everyone's dealing with, collections. How are you actually collecting in coronavirus? So stay tuned for more webinars. We've got one every day for the next week. Thanks for everything, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.